So thank you so much for coming. My name is Linda Lai. I'm a staff attorney based at U of Northern California. It's very exciting for me to see so many faces that I don't recognize. Just the diversity of people from across the state. It's very exciting, so I'm just delighted to be here. I'm going to do a little Know Your Rights on free speech and the consequences for exercising your free speech rights. Please feel free to jump in and ask questions at any point in the middle. If you want me to slow down, repeat myself, if you have an interesting question that I didn't address, don't hold it until the end of the session. So just feel free to jump in at any time. So I'm going to cover free speech and civil disobedience, and hopefully at the end of this you will feel all empowered to continue exercising your rights and to help support others in your community doing the same. So the first sort of major chunk of most of the presentation will be about free speech, and then I'll have a little bit of civil disobedience towards the end. With respect to free speech, I'm going to cover the who, what, where, and how of exercising your free speech rights. So first, who? Who does the First Amendment protect you from? The First Amendment, if you actually go back to the language of it, Congress shall make no law. That's been interpreted to extend to the state and local governments as well. But the key here to realize is that the First Amendment actually only protects our speech from interference by the government. So that means that if a private entity does something to silence your speech rights, the First Amendment doesn't actually have anything to say about that and doesn't protect us from that. So for those of you who are active in the CSU community and the UC communities, fortunately, you know, those are state entities, and so they are restrained by the First Amendment, and they do have to respect your speech rights. One thing, and this is just a little thing that I'll note, and we'll put in the parking lot because it's a separate, fascinating topic, but totally beyond the scope of what we can cover here today. The fact that private parties are not covered is a huge, huge issue. And we think of the people who care about free speech and have the luxury of thinking about free speech, think about, like, where is free speech going? What crises can we anticipate in the future of free speech? Well, the one sort of elephant in the room is that increasingly we're not having our conversations as much on the actual town square, but on the virtual town square. Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, all of these internet platforms. These platforms are not government-owned and operated. They are run by private entities. And if you read the terms of service, those things that you click agree without ever reading, including me, a lawyer, they say, you know, Twitter reserves the right to remove content at any time for any reason. So, of course, that standard of private government would be completely unsupportable, but private entities reserve the right to do that, and the First Amendment has nothing to say about that. So, just a little note to deal with, and it's a fascinating topic, but just wanted to emphasize at the outset that it's important to remember and recognize that the free speech, the federal constitutional protections actually only protect us from government censorship. They don't protect us from private
parties. Does the amendment protect
immigrants? The first, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if everyone heard the question. Does the First Amendment protect immigrants? Yes. It does not. The First Amendment does not care about your immigration status. It cares whether the government is trying to restrain what you have to say. So immigrants, regardless of your immigration status, absolutely you have a right to exercise free speech.
I'm sorry, which is
this is the free speech in your rights?
So sorry.
No, not at all. No.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sorry. Just a couple seats over here. You went to the wrong one, so.
There's some more chairs back.
So I'll just do a little brief recap. We're covering the who, what, where, and how of free speech rights, we're just on the who. And the question was, who does the First Amendment, which is the federal constitutional provision that protects our free speech rights, who does the First Amendment protect us from? And it protects us from government efforts to interfere with our free speech rights. And it doesn't protect us from private entities who might be trying to restrict what we have to say. And there was a really good question that someone raised about, does the First Amendment protect immigrants' rights to free speech? And absolutely, the answer is yes, it does. So that was the 30-second recap. So who? What does the First Amendment protect? If you had to reduce it to just a three-word blurb, it's speech, not conduct. The First Amendment protects your right to engage in speech. It does not, unfortunately, protect conduct. There's this very interesting intermediate category called expressive conduct. Sometimes we communicate not through our verbal utterances, but through engaging in certain conduct. Fortunately, the courts have recognized that this, while certain things that are technically conduct, because they can be expressive, they are entitled to First Amendment protection no less than a poem. So if you're engaged in an interpretive dance, if you're engaged in something that basically the test is whether there is an intent to convey a particularized message, and the likelihood is great that the message would be understood by those who viewed it. And sort of one of the classic cases that brought to the fore this point was whether burning a flag would be, you know, that is literally conduct, but is that expressive conduct? Clearly, yes, there's an intent to convey a message opposing something the U.S. government is doing, and people would understand that that's what you were trying to do. Putting a peace symbol on a flag, there may be a prohibition against flag desecration, but if you're stitching a peace symbol to appear on top of a flag, you are engaged in conduct. You're not uttering a word, you're not engaged in speech, but you're intending to convey a particularized message, and people would understand that if you're sewing a peace symbol to a flag, you're trying to convey a message, an anti-war message. So those are examples of things that are, although technically conduct in a literal sense, protected by the First Amendment. So what does the First Amendment protect? The key sort of to think about it is the government cannot regulate what you say, but it can regulate how you say it. That's the sort of general shorthand rule for remembering what the First Amendment protects. It protects our speech. The government can't interfere, when I say by what, I mean the content of what we say, and the protections for that are very broad, and I'll go into that in a minute. There are a few key exceptions that I'll cover also in a nutshell. Broad protections for the content of what we say. There's all kinds of great language in the cases. The government has no power to restrict expression because of its message, its ideas, or its content. And let's go through some examples of how broad the protections for what we say, just how broad that is. Foul or offensive language. Government cannot shut down our speech just because someone thinks it's foul or offensive. One of the classic cases, Cohen v. California, someone wore a jacket that said "fuck the draft" on the back of his jacket. Could he be held in contempt of court for going into a courthouse with this jacket using offensive language? Supreme Court said no. So you can fuck the draft, fuck the troops, fuck the police, fuck whatever. It's protected by the First Amendment. Racist speech. This is also protected by the First Amendment because there are very broad protections for the content of what we say. Smith v. Novato is an interesting case set in a school, actually, where a student wrote an obnoxiously offensive editorial in the school newspaper about illegal immigration. It's like, oh, you know, they're brown, they must be here illegally. And you know, I mean, it just went on and on. It was incredibly obnoxious. There was a huge controversy at the school. But the court came down very clearly that just because language, something that someone says, is racist and troubling, that doesn't mean it loses its First Amendment protection. This one is just sort of a sentimental favorite for me. I'm from Singapore, and in Asia, until relatively recently, there was this horrible toothpaste that had this image of a minstrel and this ridiculous name. They have since changed that. that, and it's now been rebranded Darlie with a white guy in a top hat, so it makes no sense whatsoever. But anyway, these are all kinds of, you know, racist speech that's actually protected by the First Amendment. Unpopular viewpoints, yes.
I had a question. The racist speech, was that, you said it was an editorial by a student?
Yes.
Was that in a school newspaper?
It was in a school newspaper.
And that's protected too, because the school doesn't have the authority to say you can't actually write. The school newspapers are funding it.
Yes.
They're teaching and supporting.
Yes. That is a great question. So in general, the schools have much more latitude, especially K-12 schools, to restrict speech than would apply if I'm just on the sidewalk out on the street. And here's an important example of where the federal law and the state law diverge. Under the federal constitutional case law, a case called Hazelwood, the Supreme Court said that a school can control the content, exercise editorial discretion over a student publication for precisely the reasons that you're talking about, because the school environment's somewhat different. You know, we worry about harassment and hostile race environments in schools, and in schools acting sort of in with parents' patria, sort of it's in the shoes of a parent. While the students are there, have more latitude to exercise control over the content of student speech in a school-sponsored publication. That's the federal law. State law, however, is different. There is an express statutory provision that diverges from the federal constitutional standard and grants an express right for students to exercise free speech, even in the context of school-sponsored publications. So that's a great question.
So where do universities fall?
Yes. So, no, that also very interesting. So the statutory provision I mentioned applies only to K-12, but the federal standards recognize that the age of a student matters, and there's a much more robust recognition of academic freedom in the university context that pushes back against the school's ability to control students. So broadcast is this whole separate area, and here's an example where the law really doesn't creates all these strange categories that don't reflect sort of current reality. So there are actually different rules for broadcast versus cable versus internet, even though in this day and age with like Apple TV, like what's the difference functionally, right? Under the current state of the doctrine, there's much more latitude for the FCC to regulate communications on broadcast television. The rationale being that broadcast, there's a limited spectrum, and the government has to dole out these licenses on the broadcast spectrum. Because it's limited, it's this public good, and the government can impose restrictions on broadcast licenses. That rationale has not been extended to the internet or to cable because there's no similar sort of physical capacity limitation. So that's the reasoning, and that's why we are in this weird situation where the government regulates stuff on broadcast but doesn't regulate stuff, or is not supposed to, on the internet. I'm not saying it makes sense, but that's what it is. And there's actually another case this term, the Supreme Court revisiting the sort of the extent to which the FCC can regulate broadcast. One of the classic FCC cases about broadcast television involved the comedian George Carlin, who, as I'm sure many of you know, has a fondness for foul language. Pacifica News was fined by the FCC for broadcasting this Carlin monologue, and that was actually upheld by the United States Supreme Court. So broadcast is this new sort of exception for where the government regulates content. Unpopular viewpoints also protected. I think one of the classic ACLU cases, defining ACLU moment, was when it defended the rights of the Nazis to march in the town of Skokie, which had a very significant Jewish population. The town had a very strong reaction, tried to shut down the speech, and the ACLU said, no, you can't do that. We obviously don't agree with anything the Nazis have to say, but we defend their right to convey their message. And the ACLU actually lost a significant portion of our membership because of this controversial decision, but it's a principle that the organization has definitely stood by over the years. unpatriotic statements, also an example of a speech that's protected. The government cannot regulate what we say just because it comes across as unpatriotic. Outrageous statements. Here's another sort of crazy and fun case. And one of the classic cases involved Hustler magazine and Jerry Falwell, who, for those of you who are too young, was a sort of prominent evangelical Christian. So Hustler magazine did this. Larry Flynn is actually a very interesting political guy who was pushing the boundaries of free speech rights. And he, at the time, in the 80s, there was this big Campari, you know, the alcohol, there was this advertising campaign about, like, your first time. And they interviewed these various celebrities and had these kind of fake interviews. And it was intended to be a very sexually suggestive campaign, suggesting that it was your first time having sex, but if you then the interview would sort of lead up to it being the first time you had Campari, and it was this sort of very memorable thing. So there was this whole Campari campaign, advertising campaign involving celebrities talking about their first time drinking Campari. Well, Hustler magazine did a similar a send-up of that campaign with Jerry Falwell. And it was about his first time, and it had this interview basically talking about this incestuous encounter he had with his mother in an outhouse. It was quite intense. And so Falwell sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, look, this is like a classic kind of parody of a major public figure, and if we allow Hustler magazine to be sued and to be liable for monetary damages for doing a send-up of a major public figure, this would go to, you know, interfere with core free speech values by interfering with the content of what we say. So outrageous statements protected by the First Amendment. There are a couple very important exceptions to the general rule that the government cannot regulate the content of what we say. And basically, the Supreme Court over the years has carved out these categories of certain kinds of speech that do not receive constitutional protection, certain categories of speech that the government is allowed to make unlawful, either through a civil punishment, monetary damages, or criminal punishment. These are four main categories are defamation, incitement, true threats, and obscenity. I'm just going to talk about them, give you a little overview of what those categories mean. Defamation. Defamation is a false assertion of fact that adversely affects someone's reputation. A key thing to remember is that opinion is absolutely not defamation because it is not an assertion of fact. So even if you articulate an opinion that's going to adversely affect someone's reputation, that cannot be considered defamation. You cannot be punished for that, either civilly or criminally, because it's a constitutionally protected opinion. So just as, you know, a little example of assertion of fact versus opinion, Mark Udoff, president of the UC system, has taken a lot of criticism over the last several years for how he's handled the budget cuts to the UC system. Udoff is a terrible president. That's an opinion, that's not defamation. Udoff embezzles money for personal gain. That would be an assertion of fact. It would adversely affect his reputation. If someone said that and they didn't have a good basis for believing that to be true, that would be defamation and they could be in trouble for that. Incitement. This was a popular way of cracking down on speech, in the 20th century, and I think we are probably, you know, seeing sort of a resurgence of that post-occupy world. Incitement, it's a very difficult standard to meet. The Supreme Court has pushed back in the 20th century on government efforts to crack down on speech that could be inciting violence. So the legal standard, in order for the government to punish speech, there has to be an utterance that is likely to lead to immediate violence. So the words must be likely to produce a clear and present danger that rises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest. So an example of something that could be potentially incitement. Imagine you're at some, you know, very confrontational, sensitive, charged situation with the police, and the police have just, you know, harmed someone, and then someone grabs a bullhorn and yells, "Shoot the cops now!" So like in Oakland, we had, after the BART shooting of Oscar Grant, an unarmed black man, and then the officer who went to trial got a very, very light sentence. There was a lot. It was a very, very volatile situation in Oakland. If someone in this sort of volatile situation had, you know, done something like that, yelled like "Shoot the cops now! Burn the shops!" It would have to be some very extreme charge situation like that to be considered incitement. Short of that, it should be protected speech. So the government likes to sort of claim incitement, but it's a high standard to meet. The First Amendment is designed to encourage controversy. You can't regulate speech just on the assumption that it might be problematic. You can't anticipate like, oh, well, someone's going to cause trouble, so I'm going to shut down the speech now. That is not an acceptable, that does not meet the standard of incitement, as much as local governments are tempted to do that all the time. True threats. This is another category of speech that is unprotected, but I want to make clear that it's a very, very high threshold before it will be considered a true threat. What you and I might just consider a threat in sort of casual parlance, just common English language, is different from what is a true threat within the meaning of the First Amendment doctrine. So it's a statement which in the entire context a reasonable person would foresee would be interpreted by those to whom the statement is communicated as a serious expression of intent to inflict bodily harm upon that person. Just to give you an example of how high the standard is for this, so in the 90s especially, there was, although unfortunately we still see remnants of this, there was a rash of violence against abortion providers. There was something called the Nuremberg Files, where the people who opposed abortion, basically a fringe extremist group, identified abortion providers, their home addresses, their children, where their children went to school, and people were killed. And they created these want ads with rewards. So the question arose, are these Nuremberg Files, basically they were trying to create a list of so-called war criminals and encouraging people to kill abortion providers. Was this a true threat? So the Ninth Circuit ultimately determined that when it got to this level, yes, you can consider that a true threat, but it was actually a very, very controversial decision, and the entire Ninth Circuit decided to, normally appellate cases are decided only by three judges on a court in the federal system. The court decided to revisit it because it was such a charged issue, and it was a very close decision. Almost half of the court said, no, we think this is protected speech. A majority said, no, this is unlawful speech. So I just want to give that as an example of how difficult these questions are, and that even when it is this extreme situation, it's not that clear. It's not that clear whether it's a true threat or not. So,
we didn't mean to commit this murder?
Yes. And so a majority of the court actually did decide it was true threats, but there were some very strong dissents by a significant number of judges. Yes, but they, I don't remember procedurally how it ended up in the Ninth Circuit.
Is this incitement or true threat?
True threats.
The definition that you read said that the person receiving the language has the fear of bodily harm.
No.
Especially an intent to inflict bodily harm on that person.
Yes, he would be interpreted to that. So you can, there's a couple different people. So there's the person who's articulating the true threat.
Right.
There's the general audience out there in the world, and how would those people, do those people think that the person articulating it is trying to is communicating a serious expression of intent to inflict harm upon someone else. So what would a reasonable listener think? How would a reasonable listener interpret the statement? If I say something horrible to you, would a reasonable person over here, Chris, interpret me as expressing a serious intent to inflict bodily harm on you, Peter?
Right, but these want ads for Teller communicated to him, Teller?
It's enough if it's communicated out there in the world. Okay. It doesn't have to be necessarily just like delivered to your mailbox. The last category is obscenity. Obscenity is not sort of the way one often uses that term, like foul language, fuck the draft, whatever. Obscenity has a special meaning in the context of First Amendment, and it's basically like kiddie porn. And it's a multi-pronged, very detailed test. I'm assuming that in the context of political protests that most of us are interested in, this is typically not going to come up, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. One thing I'll just note, in terms of categories of unlawful speech last term, the Supreme Court was addressing the question of whether California's effort to restrict violent video games was constitutionally permissible. And what the core question the court was essentially dealing with is violence a category of speech that we're going to make unlawful? And the Supreme Court very resoundingly said, no, we're not going to carve out yet another category of speech. And just because it's, extremely graphic violence, as was at issue with the violent video games, we're not going to say that this can be made unlawful. So the categories of speech that are unlawful are limited and defined: defamation, incitement, true threats, obscenity. So just to sum up, what does the First Amendment protect? Speech, not conduct. And that means basically that the government cannot regulate what you say, but it can regulate how you say it. So let's talk about the how you say it part. How and where does the First Amendment protect your speech? It protects your speech on government-owned property. The First Amendment definitely does not extend to private property. There's this wonderful, we talked a little bit about the ways in which California law is more speech protective than federal law. Another key example, actually, is on this public-private property issue. The California Supreme Court in the late 70s held that free speech protections extend to privately owned shopping malls. This is a very radical decision. A few state courts have followed it under the state constitutions, New Jersey being one of the key examples, but most have not. The California Supreme Court's rationale is that basically given sort of demographic shifts of people who, we used to huddle in the cities, but increasingly there's this suburban sprawl, and the new downtown, the new central business district where people hang out is not the city downtown, but the suburban mall. And because of that, in order for speech to flourish, we need to protect it even in privately owned shopping malls. The Supreme Court in California has been asked to extend that doctrine to an apartment building, and it declined to do so. So we don't know exactly how far the California Constitution will go in protecting our rights on private property, but it definitely does apply to privately owned shopping malls. And this may, I mentioned at the beginning, what do we do about the fact that increasingly our speech, is happening on privately owned internet platforms. I would argue that privately owned internet platforms are the new shopping mall, they're the new virtual town square, and that we should extend the California Constitution's speech rights to those platforms as well, at least in certain situations. And that's a pretty controversial thing to say, but red ACLU, so we like controversy. Yes.
I'm going to bring that up because I had a doubt on collecting signatures.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, the place to go is the mall because that's where otherwise they're just running from the car into the doors and you don't have
anything.
So it's okay, and I can tell the security guards that I'm exercising my First Amendment.
Yes. So, there's a lot of back and forth in the case law about basically shopping malls. Under the California Constitution have to respect free speech rights. They can impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, but they can't just have a flat prohibition on no signature gathering. Bizarrely, you get these strange categories in the law. So shopping malls are protected, but standalone big box stores are not. So if you stand outside a Costco, you're not going to have a good argument about having the right to be there. A shopping mall is different. I mean, the general approach that the ACLU takes when we do signature gathering is because we don't want to endanger our signature gatherers and get them. You know, we'd rather raise a challenge in the context of an affirmative civil case rather than defending someone's criminal case. So if someone asks you to leave, probably the best thing is, and you're actually gathering signatures for the ACLU, best thing is to leave, let the campaign folks know that there was a problem. We can contact them all and try to fix it going forward, but we don't want to put anyone in jeopardy, and we can push back on it in different ways.
So where would be a good place to gather signatures? You know, if I cannot go in front of a store, say like a Vons or...
Yeah, so the Vons, if the standalone store is difficult, the Vons in like a mall, I think, is a better argument. You know, the approach that we take when we work with our volunteers for signature gathering is go. If there's a controversy and someone asks you to leave, leave, but then call the campaign folks and let them know that you tried to... you tried to gather signatures there, but you were asked to leave, and then we can look into it and try to fix it going forward, but we don't want to put anyone in a bad position of getting arrested.
That's the central space, right outside the store, not in the store.
Right, yes.
Right beside by the entrance.
Yes.
So even if they ask me to leave at the entrance, I should leave.
Yeah, that would be that's the approach that we take
and
with volunteers.
And also, if it's like I do signature gathering for my labor union, like for the labor union, or I call the ACLU. No, I mean,
depends on who you're gathering signatures for.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
I just want to ask, what constitutes a mall? Like, if there's like a, you have a one business there, and then like on the outskirts is like a Starbucks and a fast food restaurant. Is that now a mall?
It's a great question, because basically the cases, and this does get litigated, it's about whether they're sort of common courtyard areas. So if it's a big, the extreme examples are, like the Westfields Mall here, like this would be considered a mall where the speech rights apply. If it's Costco, no speech rights. And then the strip malls, I think, raise sort of more difficult questions. And it's a very fact-intensive analysis of how much is there sort of common courtyards, common spaces.
And on the zoning?
That could be one of the factors, but I think it's more the physical layout of the space. We were talking about how and where does the First Amendment protect your speech. So the way the doctrine talks about it, it's there are some things called public forums and non-public forums. Basically, depending on the nature of the property, the government has more and less ability to regulate your speech. So in a public forum is like speaker's corner, parks, sidewalks, streets, places that for time immemorial have been held out for speech and assembly purposes. There are other types of government property, like the DMV, an administrative building, that they're owned by the government, but they're not the sorts of places that were intended or designed for speech purposes. They have an administrative function. So depending on the nature of property, you have the government has more or less latitude to regulate what we say. In a public forum, a park, a sidewalk, the government can't get into regulating the content of our speech. And so that's all the stuff that we were talking about earlier. They can't shut us down for saying racist, offensive, outrageous things. But in a public forum, the government can impose reasonable time, place, or manner restrictions. An example being no leafleting on the quad after midnight, no sound amplification above, X megawatts. So what are reasonable time, place, or manner regulations? What does that mean? Basically, it means that they can't be so harsh as to prevent us from getting the message across. So a 500-foot buffer zone, although that is a... by buffer zone. So like this comes up a lot with say like the Democratic Convention comes to town, or like the Olympic Torch Parade, and then they're like the Tibet anti-China protests, or the WTO. right? So this comes up all the time, and there's like a big convention center, protesters want to protest. What if the government says, yeah, we can, you can protest, but it's going to be on the other side of town? Although literally a place, a, you know, that literally a time, place, or manner restriction, that would not be a reasonable time, place, or manner restriction to say that the protesters can only protest 500 feet, a mile away, because then they can't reasonably get their message across. So just the fact that the government's regulating where we're saying the speech doesn't mean that it's a reasonable time, place, or manner restriction. Typical time, place, or manner restrictions that come up are permit requirements. Permit requirements are okay, but they have to be reasonable. So what does that mean? The reason why the government can ask you to get a permit if you want to have a street festival with 10,000 people is because the government has to regulate competing uses of the space. If you want to put something in Golden Gate Park, the Strictly Bluegrass Festival, for example, that's a big music festival that happens in the fall of each year, you have to get permits in order to use the park, even though the park is a public forum, because by having 10,000 people come to listen to music, you're precluding other people from using the space. So the government can basically ask you to, like, you know, make a reservation if you're going to use, take up a public space in a way that's going to prevent other people from using it, because other people have a right to use it too, and the government's there to sort of try to balance and, you know, mediate between the different uses. So permit requirements are okay if that's what they're trying to do, but there are limitations. Again, permit requirements have to be reasonable. So if they grant a license from the official what's called unbridled discretion, so they just can make up the rules. Some, you know, bureaucrat sitting in the basement says, well, you know, I like what Jeff has to say, but I don't like what Peter has to say. You can't exercise that kind of unbridled discretion. That's censorship. And so even, you know, just because you're calling it a permit requirement doesn't mean that it's okay. It has to be a reasonable permit requirement. And if you have no criteria for how you grant the permit, that's too much discretion. And then there's the danger that someone's going to make a decision about permitting based on whether they like the speech or not. That runs at odds with free speech principles. That's not okay. Another sort of interesting thing with permit requirements is that they are not acceptable in the Ninth Circuit, where we live in California, if they're applied to for small demonstrations. So the government, if you're, say, like two or three people hanging out of the sidewalk and you want to protest, you're engaging in this protest, the government can't come and say, hey, you can't have a sidewalk protest, you need a permit first. The reason for permit requirements, as I was saying, the justification for permit requirements is that the government's trying to balance between competing uses of the space. So if you are a large demonstration of, you know, 300 people and you're going to take up the street and the sidewalk, they can ask you to get a permit in advance so that they can plan accordingly. But if you're only three or four people, they cannot try to shut down your speech by saying, oh, you needed to apply for a permit, because three or four people is no more obstructive of the sidewalk, doesn't take up any more sidewalk room than if we had just been walking down the street at rush hour. So if the government tries to shut down your speech and you're just a small group, by saying you needed a permit, but you're just a small group of people, that's unreasonable. And the reason why we do that is because we want to protect the ability to engage in spontaneous and anonymous speech. Yep.
Is 50 like the legal standard? Mm-hmm. Like, so if you're trying to get around like restrictions, mm-hmm. like, okay, only 49 of us go to do this.
Yeah. Okay. 50 is a number from case law.
Okay.
I mean, if you're in a, you have to sort of use your judgment. Like,
we're blocking the sidewalk.
If you're blocking the sidewalk, you're blocking the sidewalk, right? But they can't formally require you to have a permit. And there's some good cases on that had the number 50. But again, if you're obstructing pedestrian ingress or egress, you know, in and out of a building, they can get you on that. So in the public forum, reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. In a non-public forum, like the DMV, the government has a lot of ability to regulate what we say. The only limitation is that the government must be viewpoint neutral. So just to take an example, the government could say no one is allowed to hand out leaflets inside the DMV waiting room, because they can say, like, look, we're just, this is for people to come and get their, they're waiting here, they're trying to get their driver's license, they're stuck inside, we don't want them to have to be harassed or bothered by someone leafleting and sticking a flyer while they're just, like, studying for their DMV test. That would be okay, and it would be very difficult to challenge that kind of requirement. But inside the DMV waiting room, what the government cannot do is say, oh, well, you're opposed to the death penalty, we're going to prevent you from leafleting, you're in favor of the death penalty, we're going to let you leaflet. So that would be taking, weighing in on one side of the debate. That would be viewpoint discrimination. And while the government can say no leafleting at all inside the DMV, it cannot say only leafleting on one side of the debate. So there's that's the limitation for non-public school. Yeah.
This occurs to me now because
you speak up there.
Outgrowth of a complaint I got in a charter school, and I know that presents all sorts of issues about, you know, K through 12, etc. And I couldn't find any public funding for it. At least I didn't know. This young woman wanted to wear a T-shirt which was on your heart boobs because of, you know, breast cancer, etc.
Yeah.
And the school wouldn't let her do it because they thought it was inappropriate.
Right.
I didn't really find a good handle on how to approach that. I thought they could probably do it.
Would
state money have made that much of a difference just because there was an alternative money?
So the school question is an interesting question, and somewhat of a subset, and the charter school question is also very interesting overlay about that. So the general standard for schools is the school government gets to regulate a lot more of what students say. The test is actually, does it cause a material and substantial disruption? The original case, really interesting, in the ACLU of Illinois, I think it was, had a role in it. Students during the Vietnam War wanted to wear black armbands to school to protest the war, and the school tried to prevent them from doing that because they said, oh, it's going to cause, you know, this is a controversial topic, we can't have this in the schools. The Supreme Court said in that case that students do not shed their rights when they cross the schoolhouse gates, but the school has this special responsibility to maintain an educational environment, so it can't be fuck the draft, fuck the police, Jerry Falwell outrageous statements in the middle of class, right? Like, if the teacher tells you, shut up, you're interrupting me, you know, that wouldn't be okay on the sidewalk, but it's okay for classroom management inside the classroom. However, students don't lose their rights entirely, so the test is, will it cause a material and substantial disruption? The court concluded in the Timber case that the armbands did not, and so it was constitutionally protected. So there have been lots of I Heart Boobies cases all over the country.
Private schools?
Private schools, we would not be able to reach. Charter schools, because in California they receive, they're substantially subsidized. The position that we take, they receive public money, basically the money that they, that based on average daily attendance, that a K-12 school would get, goes to the charter school instead. We take the position that charter schools are subject to constitutional requirements.
Is there any case law on that?
I haven't found case law directly on that yet, but I also haven't found any to the controversy. And given the Ed Code statutory scheme, I think there's a very, very good argument that they are subject to constitutional requirements.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, that's the non-public forum. Okay, so basically, to sum up, if you're planning a protest in a public forum, so this is the street, sidewalks, park, the government cannot regulate the content of what you say, it can't regulate what you say, but it can regulate how you say it by imposing reasonable time, place, or manner restrictions. So they can say, no sound amplification, please get a permit if you're bringing in 1,000 people, but the restrictions have to be reasonable. Very case-sensitive question, hard to say broad rules, but hard to impose black and white rules. And just from a planning perspective, check the permitting requirements. The local permitting requirements. Question? Sure. Okay. Okay, so that's like the First Amendment in 40 minutes or less. civil disobedience. I called it the SPLIN because I've done this presentation, sorry, for university students a number of times. But what happens when you leave the sort of ambit of what's constitutionally protected? What can the government do to you? Remember, speech is protected, including expressive conduct, but pure conduct is not protected. And so the government, when you cross the line from this to this, the government can do something. It can take either civil or criminal action. So this could mean, for example, if you're a student at UC or CSU, that you could be subject to student conduct charges, or you might face a civil tort liability if you defame someone, or you could be exposed to criminal punishment.
Is videotaping something, a conduct issue that can be regulated?
So videotaping, that's a great question. That's a very hot First Amendment topic. You know, I remember the Rodney King situation back in the 90s where someone caught on videotape the LAPD just beating the crap out of a black man. And it was so unusual back then for someone to be carrying a VHS recorder on their shoulder and just like have it handy. But times have changed, and now, you know, people have smartphones with video recordings. So we're seeing recordings of police misconduct in a way that was just not technologically likely earlier. So it's a huge question of whether you can be, whether videotaping is protected. The First Circuit has, which is on the East Coast, encompasses Massachusetts, has probably one of the best cases that sort of encapsulates how absolutely recording police misconduct in a public place is protected by the First Amendment. There's a First Amendment right to collect information. There's a First Amendment right to report on newsworthy issues, on matters of public interest. And when we're recording public officials in a public place, and very importantly, we're not interfering with the with government operations, then it's protected and you can't be punished for doing that, recording that important information. Now, if you're recording in a way that's interfering with the ability of law enforcement to exercise their duties, then it's going to leave the protected zone and get into the conduct zone. But if you're just standing back here, you're not interfering with what they're doing, but you're just recording and capturing it, you know, police will try to arrest you for that and try to give you grief. The law in the First Circuit is perfect, and we'd love to litigate a case in the Ninth Circuit. civil disobedience. So this is a time-honored tradition of the civil rights movement, from sitting at segregated lunch counters to students protesting tuition hikes at UC Davis. What is civil disobedience? It is the conscious refusal to comply with the law as a form of protest. So the thing that's interesting here is that, you know, we talked about expressive conduct, like burning a flag. The test for expressive conduct is, do you have an intent to communicate a particularized message that the audience, the listener, would understand you were trying to do? So if expressive conduct, like burning a flag, is protected, why is civil disobedience not protected? The intent is expressive. You're trying to communicate your message of protest. But the mere fact that you're doing something for a reason, for a First Amendment, for a sort of a political reason, doesn't mean that you will always get protection. So when you burn down a building, you could be protesting, you know, the fact that the NSA is highly corrupt, or the Pentagon is, you know, is engaging in a war abroad. But that crosses the line from expressive protected conduct into civil disobedience. Therefore, you can be disciplined or arrested. So, things to consider before you engage in civil disobedience. Immigration consequences. We talked about whether the First Amendment protects the speech rights of immigrants. Yes, absolutely. But if you are engaging in civil disobedience, you can be arrested. There's a very controversial program called Secure Communities where local law enforcement transmit information to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. If you are arrested, even if you ultimately do not have charges prosecuted against you, the information, your information could get relayed to ICE, and there could be pretty irreparable consequences after that. So it's before people engage in civil disobedience, we just urge them to think through the consequences, to be educate yourself about the consequences, and then make an informed decision. So potential immigration consequences. Separately, do you have a warrant out for your arrest on something else? If you get arrested at a protest and you have a warrant out for something else on your arrest, then you're going to get on the radar, so keep that in mind. Are you on probation or parole? If you are considered to be violating the terms of your parole could be revoked, potential consequences there. And ultimately, even if none of these apply, you could get a permanent record. Employers love to ask to prospective applicants, have you ever been convicted of a crime? It should not be, you know, the ACLU position is that that should not be determinative of whether you had a job. It should only be, you know, they should only look into things that are job related. So if you got arrested at a demo, why should you be disqualified from applying for a job or from getting hired? But as a practical matter, employers really look at this stuff. Just practical tips, if you decide to engage in civil disobedience, carry an ID. It will make your life upon booking much easier. Your life on booking will be awful and a pain in the neck anyway, so don't make it worse by not carrying an ID. Key rights if you are arrested. Right to remain silent, we've all seen that on TV. You do have to say your name and address, but you don't need to say anything else. If you don't give your name and address, your life in booking will be miserable, and the police will make it miserable. You have the right to legal counsel, 3 local phone calls within 3 hours of your arrest, plus more if you need to deal with child care issues. And if you are kept in custody, a judge has to review your case within 2 business days. The business days part is really important, so Saturday and Sunday are not a business day, so don't get arrested on a Thursday afternoon. just quickly, student discipline. If you're at a UC, CSU, or community college, if you're in the, you know, building occupation, what have you, tents on the plaza is the recent one, you can be brought up for student discipline charges. There's a general right to due process, so that means notice and an opportunity to be heard. They can't just, you know, say, oh, you know, student conduct is considering, disciplining you, but then not telling you what they're trying to discipline you for, what rule you broke. There is no hard and fast rule about what process precisely is required, but generally what this seems to mean is sort of notice of what the charges are, what the evidence against you is, opportunity to contest the charges, something approaching a fair and unbiased decision maker, and in most cases the hearing needs to occur before they impose the punishment, right? Like, they can't prejudge the situation. There's some situations where an interim suspension is okay, so for example in like a rape case or some kind of assailant, if they're worried about someone who is presenting an immediate health and safety threat to the campus community, that a school should be able to impose an interim suspension while the charges are actually being worked out. But those are rare, and just because someone set up a tent on a university quad, that should not be the basis for an interim suspension, although I know some schools have tried to do that. So basically, the general rule is that the more severe the punishment, the more process they're required to provide. Although, of course, because at the beginning of the process, they don't know what the punishment is going to be, they should be providing the same good amount of process for everyone. I have a little hypo, but I think maybe I'll just do Q&A for now. This was a fun poster that I saw coming out of some of the UC protests. There were students who protested the Regents meeting, and then a UC cop who completely overreacted and pulled his gun. They had this very satiric poster. This is an actual picture. Pay your fees or I'll shoot you. And the UC Berkeley Police Department reacted very quickly to that. Protected or unprotected? How many hands for protected speech? Yeah. Any hands for unprotected speech? One.
Isn't it a threat? I'll shoot you. Does that constitute a threat?
So who's conveying the message, and who do you think is... So who's threatening whom?
Police.
So interesting question. So we have one vote for defamation, one vote for true threats. Anything else?
No, I just go with that.
Defamation? Okay. So let's start with the true threats thing. So Peter raised an important point about, like, wait, who's listening? Who is the person who's communicating? Who's threatening? So here, the speaker is the protest, the poster creator. And then the poster creator depicted the officer. So if the officer literally said, hey, your fees or I'll shoot you, that would be a true threat. But here we have the speaker is the person who created the poster. And that person was not trying to shoot anyone, but conveying a satiric parody, of what... What were you going to say?
That's what I was going to ask you, if it's political satire or some kind of satire.
Exactly. So the basically, it's a send-up, right? The poster, person who created a poster was sort of making a satire as... basically saying that, you know, UC is being so coercive and heavy-handed about tuition increases that it's equivalent to the cop saying, pay your fees or I'll shoot you. So it was a mocking the statement of the police. It wasn't actually communicating that the poster creator was trying to shoot anyone. So defamation, that was an interesting argument as well. If the poster creator said, hey, the police officer said, pay your fees or I'll shoot you, that and tried to represent that as an assertion of fact, then that would be defamatory. If they falsely accused the police officer of saying, pay your fees or I'll shoot you, I think that's a very good argument that would be a false assertion of fact that would adversely affect the police officer's reputation. But there's a difference between parody and a false assertion of fact. So would the test then is, would a reasonable audience member have understood the creator of the poster to be making a parody of the police officer or actually trying to represent that this is what the police officer said? So with defamation cases, you actually get a lot of situations where the courts are analyzing, was the speaker actually trying to convey something, or were they just making a parody, and no one, you know, and a reasonable person wouldn't have actually understood it as a representation that this is what the police officer said. Yes?
I have a question. On the bottom where they say for more information, contact, would that, putting that on there, protect them even more so that it's clear where it's coming from? You see what I'm saying? Like you said that part of the standard is would a reasonable person get it, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you're putting down who's generating this, you'd assume that it's being generated from that group, that would help protect them even more?
I think that's a good argument. Like if you just, the more sort of context, context that you raise to show, we're this group that opposes student fee, and this is what we're doing, that can be helpful to the analysis. There was someone else, and then I'll come back.
Well,
to
I was
separate
too.
Oh, okay.
So on this poster where it says mobilize Berkeley, what if it said Jerry Brown, Governor Jerry Brown? That would not be a defamation of character because he's saying, I'll shoot you?
So it's like a false attribution?
Correct. Or for more info. Yeah.
If it were in quotes, maybe.
Well, that's what I was saying. That's a fact.
Well, yeah.
In another direction. It is an interest mark.
So wait, I'm sorry. So it.
So you're attributing to Governor Brown he's saying that the pay your fees, the students aren't criminals by putting it on there. If you want more information, call him. Even though he had no.
He had nothing to do with it. I'm not sure that would change the analysis much because I think it would be pretty, in general, I think a court would see this as clearly a satire.
Okay.
room was, if anything, maybe Jerry Brown's name would make it more obvious.
I'll get more information on this.
Right, but it could be somebody that, it could be like the police chief.
Call back, right, yeah. Let's spam them with some protest email.
Would quotation marks change it? If the pay your fees or I'll shoot, that was like putting quotes and then it said actual picture. Would that change it, implying that the cop actually did say that, even though they're not saying he said that?
What if it was a cop that wasn't in the picture?
I think it's one factor. I think it's helpful that it says actual picture, right? Because it doesn't say actual statement, right? So they went out of their way to say the picture was true, but that suggests by negative inference that the quotation
marks. But they're just to put quotation marks around it. Because if you're putting quotation marks around it, to me that would almost imply like, look, this is an actual picture, we're quoting someone.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that could, I think, raise more complications.
If it's a political figure, wasn't there a recent ruling that basically essentially said political figures are allowed to lie? It is perfectly legal for a political figure to lie. So if it was Jerry Brown up there and it was in quotes, it would be completely legal under those.
In terms of political figures, I think, again, the sort of defamation context is always very contextual, so it's always what would a reasonable person have understood. So sometimes you do get these cases that say, well, in political debate, there's sort of extreme statements and no one really believes them anyway, so no one would think it's an assertion of fact. The other interesting and important thing to note for political figures is that if you defame a political figure, it's much harder to prove, to hold you liable for it. Basically, if I defame an ordinary person, then in order for that person to sue me for defamation, they just have to prove it's a false assertion of fact that adversely affects their reputation. If I defame Jerry Brown, who's a public figure, Jerry Brown has to prove false assertion of fact that adversely affects his reputation, plus that I had what's called actual malice, that I made the false assertion with knowledge or a reckless disregard for the falsity of the statement. So it's a very, it's hard to deal with.
Isn't the question of whether lying is protected before the court right now?
Yes. There's an interesting case called the statute called the Stolen Valor Act, which makes it a criminal to make a false assertion about having received a military honor. That someone made a representation about having received, I don't remember what kind of medal it was. Professional Medal of Honor.
City Council.
And then the question is whether he can be criminally punished for that.
Do you know if they're going to, and I haven't seen the documentary about it, but punish that woman who said she was actually an animal, but she wasn't? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, no, I don't actually.
It's coming on the ID channel on Tuesday.
I see.
But it turns out some like huge thing in the New York.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. What did she say?
She said she has a minor one, but she wasn't.
It was a controversy about someone who claims that she was a minor one, but wasn't. Yeah. And that she's trying to, they're trying to criminally charge her, or
I don't know.
Interesting. Jeff and Lynn.
I remember seeing the documentary about the Chicago 11 or so that were arrested for intent to incite riot and crossing a state line with intent to it. Was that thrown out for constitutional reasons? Do you remember?
This was Chicago? DNC's
1968 Democratic Convention. They were convicted and put in jail for a few years, but weren't they eventually thrown out?
I forgot. Tom Hayden eventually ran for state senate, so I think
they did okay. They were put in jail for it's the charge when you like act out in court. They weren't they weren't actually convicted for the charges.
Okay, I just remember there was a law that if you cross state lines with intent to incite a riot, you were
brought up in some federal charge, interstate punishment.
Why are there no laws that protect citizens from corporations infringing
Unfortunately, the First Amendment, well, fortunately or unfortunately, the law is that the First Amendment doesn't restrict private entities' ability to censor our speech. So, for example, if you go on Facebook, the terms of service are that you will not, bully or intimidate or harass, use annoying language. That by contract, they restrict your ability to speak out in all kinds of ways that if it were the government would not be able to do. But the First Amendment only restrains the government's ability to censor us. It does not restrain private parties' ability to enter us. So the state of the law is generally that, except for shopping malls in California, it's a matter of contract between two parties, and the First Amendment doesn't weigh in. It's a hugely important issue, and I think especially since increasingly we're having so much of a public debate that's happening on the internet, where privately owned platforms are the key intermediaries of that speech. It's a huge problem that the First Amendment does not protect our speech rights as vis-a-vis private entities, but unfortunately that's what the law is.
We have so much power and so much influence, we can still stop the individual from expressing the right of the speech. Is that because they have the same rights as an individual?
No, it's from a doctrine in constitutional law called the state action doctrine, which means that the Constitution, the federal Constitution, protects individual rights when the government does something. It doesn't try to moderate and mediate between private parties, whether it's two private individuals or two private corporations or a private corporation and an individual. In fact, that there's an imbalance of power. The Constitution just doesn't weigh in on that. Unfortunately, that is what it is.
Are there any dangers or something like that occurring?
Yeah, I think we're seeing it on the internet all the time. In just some recent examples, the Yahoo Mail. It was found that this blog called Pink Progress exposed in September 2011, just as the Occupy Wall Street protests were getting off the ground, that if you tried to send an email with the subject line OccupyWallStreet.org, it got blocked. It wouldn't go through. And as soon as Think Progress sort of blew the whistle on that, Yahoo went, oof, sorry, little glitch with our spam server. It wasn't intentional. I mean, who knows what it really was. Maybe it really was a glitch. But it just shows you that that's really one powerful example of how we depend so much on these private entities to make our speech happen, but we don't have any constitutional hook, not under the federal constitution, to protect our rights there.
On the flip side of that, fairly recently, wasn't there some ruling where corporations now are being treated more like people and having protections and rights that people would get?
I think you're probably referring to Citizens United, which was a federal campaign elections law decision. And it that situation involved a group that made a anti-Hillary Clinton little documentary sort of piece. And the question was that part of, was that a sort of campaign speech that had to be subject to the federal campaign requirements? The Supreme Court went far further than it needed to decide that case. And it said, yes, corporations, as much as individuals, have free speech rights. And so this is it's a very controversial decision. There are reasons why we, the ACLU, like parts of that. Sometimes the ACLU is an incorporation under the under the laws of the state of California, and we exercise our right to free speech all the time. Labor unions sometimes are incorporated, sometimes they're unincorporated, but they are the relevant thing would be non-natural persons, right? So they're a labor union, whatever form it takes, partnership, unincorporated association, whatever. These are just sort of intricacies of state law. But sometimes people need to band together, whether in the form of a church, a labor union, or Monsanto. And there isn't really a principled way to say the church and the labor union have speech rights when people come together in group. there isn't really a principled way to say that these have speech rights, but Monsanto doesn't. So.
So kind of going off what she was saying about the private companies, does the First Amendment protect us from, let's say Facebook didn't have anything about curse words?
Uh-huh.
Does the First Amendment protect from the government going to Mark Zuckerberg and saying, hey, could you start censoring this, please?
Yes. That's a very important point. So then, when the government is trying to interfere, through subpoena process with anonymous speech, or when the government's putting pressure on private entities, there are ways we can use the First Amendment as a hook. But if it's purely a contractual thing because Facebook decided that in its business interest it wants to do X, whereas it's very difficult to challenge unless we can successfully make the argument under the state constitution that platforms are like the new shopping malls, which is a challenge.
So we're in a public meeting, like a board of supervisors or something, and they say that you can speak for so many minutes in the beginning, mm-hmm. and they can limit that to like 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that only allows for like 10 speakers. Yeah. That's all okay?
So those are pretty difficult to challenge because, they're trying to maintain an orderly process. It's a little bit like a permitting requirement to say, well, we're going to just have a first-come, first-served thing so that, everyone, and we're going to limit people to 1 minute or 3 minutes because we want to give as many people a right to speak as possible, and we can't go on forever, so we're going to cut it off at 30 minutes. I have not seen a successful challenge to that kind of thing. As long as it's, mutually enforced. If they only invoke that, if you can, prove, if you can make the factual claim that they only invoke that rule when they know that they're going to have huge opposition on something. But as a general matter, at other meetings, they let people drone on for hours and hours. And then you can show that whatever their rule is, they're actually, in fact, enforcing something that discriminate based on viewpoint. If you can make that kind of factual showing, then there might be a potential claim that you have to show pretty extreme facts.
So recently the medical marijuana thing came up in Chester County, and 500 people are at the city council meeting. Normally there's 50.
Mm-hmm.
They cut off the talk, but the police chief was able to speak for 13 minutes, giving the same, the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason to say that the police chief should have only 3 minutes or whatever the public had. That might be one of those cases you mentioned.
I think that's a little bit of a harder one because it's the, they might want to put someone specifically on the agenda in order to get the perspective of their agency to hear from the police agency. I mean, there are rational reasons to have the police chief speak for longer. If they had... I hear you. From a court's perspective, that would be rational reasons to put the, to give more time to the police chief to speak. But if they said, people who support the police chief get 5 minutes and people who oppose the police chief get 2 minutes, right, because those speakers are similarly situated. I think the first 2 minutes.
I have two, but I think the quick question.
Okay.
One was like, if you say it was a small gathering, a park, wherever, and you had to sign whether it's happy birthday or free driving man, is the sign you protected?
So we had a situation in Humboldt recently where they just passed a new emergency ordinance sort of in response to Occupy about restricting signs on the sort of courthouse property. What was acceptable about the ordinance is that they were limiting, they were basically saying you cannot affix a sign, attach a sign to physical property. Now, the government could do that in order to protect, vandalism, protect degradation, protect the degradation of public property. But if you're just up there holding a sign, there's no basis for you. There's no basis for the government to restrict either Happy Birthday or Bradley Manning.
You held it up tight into something like Velcro and tied it around?
So I think if they're basically saying, don't tie stuff to trees because it's going to hurt and kill the tree and then we're going to have to incur landscaping costs for the tree, doing that is okay. The government can do that, but if the government is selectively enforcing and they're allowing all the happy birthday signs, but they're not allowing the political signs, then I think it gets much more murky. But you would have to make the factual showing of that, this kind of discrimination.
I am, it's called ACLU Northern California about 4.5 months ago when I was doing petitions for SAFE and asked if I could bring you to my workplace.
And asked, I'm sorry?
If I could bring you to my workplace.
Uh-huh.
It's a public place.
Right.
And they were like, this happens to be somewhere. And they were like, really? The bag team talked to you. You and you first. So then I talked to you and then I talked to their lawyer. And then I got back to you guys. And then they said, probably they'll just get back to the job.
Said what?
To protect my job. They'll
right,
really
right.
So that's yeah. Why I did it. Yeah. But that was a recent thing about it.
Yeah. So the I think in a lot of those situations you would get, so private property, so if it's a private employer, then you don't get the first amendment. But if it's a state employer, the state government employers have more, just like in the school's context, when the school is acting in the capacity, when the government's acting in the capacity as an educator, or in the capacity of an employer, they have far more latitude to restrict public employee speech because they're not acting as the government out there in the world restricting what you have to say, but they're trying to run a workplace.
Right.
And then so the rationale is that they have a lot more ability to regulate employee speech because they're not acting as the sovereign government. They're acting as an employer trying to get a function done. So there's an interesting line of case law about public employee speech and the different standards that applies there.
So,
sorry, I'm
just
trying to keep people in order.
Okay,
Chris, and then
Dave.
Okay.
All this case law is nice, but
sometimes it's not really actually.
Well, yeah. We have the Attorney General Eric Holder giving a speech at Northwestern University a month or two ago, saying defending the executive branch right to assassinate a 16-year-old American citizen in the United States anytime they want to, based on incitement, but not even incitement of, they fully acknowledge that they did not have information leading to any imminent actions coming up.
Are you talking about the targeted kill list?
The targeted kill list that was actually executed a year ago, right? Against the 16-year-old U.S. citizen. The son was 16.
Oh,
it was two weeks
right.
After the father. They're defending that right, which seems like it throws out all of these laws, all of this case history.
Are you objecting to what Holder, the fact that Holder said that, or the fact that the U.S. government killed people?
Well, the fact that the U.S. government killed people extrajudicially, it seems, is discomforting to me.
I agree.
And because there's no case law supporting it, it would seem.
War on terror thing has definitely produced like the sort of giant exception you can run, a very large slight claim through. The courts have taken a very deferential view of what's called the state's secrets doctrine. So whenever the government says, oops, sorry, we can't talk about that, it's a secret, then the courts have been extremely deferential and saying, well, you're national security, we're not going to ask you about it, okay, fine. We just have to leave it to the political process and to trust you. They certainly have been trying to push, push the envelope on here, but we've met with a lot of defeats in the courts because they've been, no court wants to be responsible for, not shutting down the next 9/11 bomber. And the government uses that bogeyman all the time. I hear people outside. Does anyone know what time this was supposed to end? Like hours ago?
3 o'clock.
Oh,
we have no minutes.
Okay. The next thing starts at 3:45. Okay. So I don't want to hold you up. Thank you so much. If there are more questions people want to chat with, please, thanks to Fran for that. Thank you so much.